Bushido as an ethical system. Chivalry is a flower no less indigenous to the soil of Japan than its emblem, the cherry blossom, nor is it a dried-up specimen of an antique virtue preserved in the herbarium of our history. It is still a living object of power and beauty among us, and if it assumes no tangible shape or form, it not the less scents the moral atmosphere, and makes us aware that we are still under its potent spell. The conditions of society which brought it forth and nourished it have long disappeared, but as those far-off stars which once were and are not, still continue to shed their rays upon us, so the light of chivalry, which was a child of feudalism, still illuminates our moral path, surviving its mother institution. It is a pleasure to me to reflect upon this subject in the language of Burke, who uttered the well-known touching eulogy over the neglected beer of its European prototype. It argues a sad defect of information concerning the Far East, when so erudite a scholar as Dr. George Miller did not hesitate to affirm that chivalry, or any other similar institution, has never existed either among the nations of antiquity or among the modern Orientals. Such ignorance, however, is amply excusable, as the third edition of the good doctor's work appeared the same year that Commodore Perry was knocking at the portals of our exclusivism. More than a decade later, about the time that our feudalism was in the last throes of existence, Karl Marx, writing his Capital, called the attention of his readers to the peculiar advantage of studying the social and political institutions of feudalism, as then to be seen in living form only in Japan. I would likewise invite the Western historical and ethical student to the study of chivalry in the Japan of the present. Enticing as is a historical disquisition on the comparison between European and Japanese feudalism and chivalry, it is not the purpose of this paper to enter into it at length. My attempt is rather to relate, _firstly_, the origin and sources of our chivalry, _secondly_, its character and teaching, _thirdly_, its influence among the masses, and, _fourthly_, the continuity and permanence of its influence. Of these several points, the first will be only brief and cursory, or else I should have to take my readers into the devious paths of our national history. The second will be dwelt upon at greater length, as being most likely to interest students of international ethics and comparative ethology in our ways of thought and action, and the rest will be dealt with as corollaries. The Japanese word which I have roughly rendered chivalry is, in the original, more expressive than horsemanship. _bushido_ means literally military knight, ways the ways which fighting nobles should observe in their daily life as well as in their vocation, in a word, the precepts of knighthood, the _noblesse oblige_ of the warrior class. Having thus given its literal significance, I may be allowed henceforth to use the word in the original. The use of the original term is also advisable for this reason, that a teaching so circumscribed and unique, engendering a cast of mind and character so peculiar, so local, must wear the badge of its singularity on its face. Then, some words have a national _timbre_ so expressive of race characteristics that the best of translators can do them but scant justice, not to say positive injustice and grievance. Who can improve by translation what the German _gemeth_ signifies, or who does not feel the difference between the two words verbally so closely allied as the English _gentleman_ and the French _gentilhomme_? Bushido, then, is the code of moral principles which the knights were required or instructed to observe. It is not a written code, at best it consists of a few maxims handed down from mouth to mouth or coming from the pen of some well-known warrior or savant. More frequently it is a code unuttered and unwritten, possessing all the more the powerful sanction of veritable deed, and of a law written on the fleshly tablets of the heart. It was founded not on the creation of one brain, however able, or on the life of a single personage, however renowned. It was an organic growth of decades and centuries of military career. It, perhaps, fills the same position in the history of ethics that the English Constitution does in political history, yet it has had nothing to compare with the Magna Carta or the Habeas Corpus Act. True, early in the 17th century military statutes, _bucato_, were promulgated, but their 13 short articles were taken up mostly with marriages, castles, leagues, etc., and didactic regulations were but meagerly touched upon. We cannot, therefore, point out any definite time and place and say, here is its fountainhead. Only as it attains consciousness in the feudal age, its origin, in respect to time, may be identified with feudalism. But feudalism itself is woven of many threads, and Bushido shares its intricate nature. As in England the political institutions of feudalism may be said to date from the Norman conquest, so we may say that in Japan its rise was simultaneous with the ascendancy of Yoritomo, late in the 12th century. As, however, in England, we find the social elements of feudalism far back in the period previous to William the Conqueror, so, too, The germs of feudalism in Japan had been long existent before the period I have mentioned. Again, in Japan as in Europe, when feudalism was formally inaugurated, the professional class of warriors naturally came into prominence. These were known as _samurai_, meaning literally, like the Old English _knight_, connect, knight, guards or attendants resembling in character the _soldiery_ whom Caesar mentioned as existing in Aquitania, or the _comitati_, who, according to Tacitus, followed Germanic chiefs in his time, or, to take a still later parallel, the _milites medii_ that one reads about in the history of medieval Europe. A Sino-Japanese word _buk_ or _byushi_, fighting knights, was also adopted in common use. They were a privileged class, and must originally have been a rough breed who made fighting their vocation. This class was naturally recruited, in a long period of constant warfare, from the manliest and the most adventurous, and all the while the process of elimination went on, the timid and the feeble being sorted out, and only a rude race, all masculine, with brutish strength, to borrow Emerson's phrase, surviving to form families and the ranks of the _samurai_, coming to profess great honor and great privileges, and correspondingly great responsibilities, they soon felt the need of a common standard of behavior, especially as they were always on a belligerent footing and belonged to different clans. Just as physicians limit competition among themselves by professional courtesy, just as lawyers sit in courts of honor in cases of violated etiquette, so must also warriors possess some resort for final judgment on their misdemeanors. Fair play in fight. What fertile germs of morality lie in this primitive sense of savagery and childhood? Is it not the root of all military and civic virtues? We smile, as if we had outgrown it, at the boyish desire of the small Britisher, Tom Brown, to leave behind him the name of a fellow who never bullied a little boy or turned his back on a big one. And yet, who does not know that this desire is the cornerstone on which moral structures of mighty dimensions can be reared? May I not go even so far as to say that the gentlest and most peace-loving of religions endorses this aspiration? This desire of Tom's is the basis on which the greatness of England is largely built, and it will not take us long to discover that _Bushido_ does not stand on a lesser pedestal. If fighting in itself, be it offensive or defensive, is, as Quakers rightly testify, brutal and wrong, we can still say with Lessing, we know from what failings our virtue springs. Sneaks and cowards are epithets of the worst opprobrium to healthy, simple natures. Childhood begins life with these notions, and knighthood also, but, as life grows larger and its relations many-sided, the early faith seeks sanction from higher authority and more rational sources for its own justification, satisfaction and development. If military interests had operated alone, without higher moral support, how far short of chivalry would the ideal of knighthood have fallen? In Europe, Christianity, interpreted with concessions convenient to chivalry, infused it nevertheless with spiritual data. Religion, war and glory were the three souls of a perfect Christian knight, says Lamartine. In Japan there were several sources of Bushido, of which I may begin with Buddhism. It furnished a sense of calm trust in fate, a quiet submission to the inevitable, that stoic composure in sight of danger or calamity, that disdain of life and friendliness with death. A foremost teacher of swordsmanship, when he saw his pupil master the utmost of his art, told him, "Beyond this my instruction must give way to Zen teaching." Zen is the Japanese equivalent for the dhyana, which represents human effort to reach through meditation zones of thought beyond the range of verbal expression. Its method is contemplation, and its purport, as far as I understand it, to be convinced of a principle that underlies all phenomena, and, if it can, of the absolute itself, and thus to put oneself in harmony with this absolute. Thus defined, the teaching was more than the dogma of a sect, and whoever attains to the perception of the absolute raises himself above mundane things and awakes, to a new heaven and a new earth. What Buddhism failed to give, Shintoism offered in abundance. Such loyalty to the sovereign, such reverence for ancestral memory, and such filial piety as are not taught by any other creed, were inculcated by the Shinto doctrines, imparting passivity to the otherwise arrogant character of the samurai. Shinto theology has no place for the dogma of original sin. On the contrary, it believes in the innate goodness and godlike purity of the human soul, adoring it as the adytum from which divine oracles are proclaimed. Everybody has observed that the Shinto shrines are conspicuously devoid of objects and instruments of worship, and that a plain mirror hung in the sanctuary forms the essential part of its furnishing. The presence of this article is easy to explain. It typifies the human heart, which, when perfectly placid and clear, reflects the very image of the deity. When you stand, therefore, in front of the shrine to worship, You see your own image reflected on its shining surface, and the act of worship is tantamount to the old Delphic injunction, know thyself. But self-knowledge does not imply, either in the Greek or Japanese teaching, knowledge of the physical part of man, not his anatomy or his psychophysics. Knowledge was to be of a moral kind, the introspection of our moral nature. Mommsen, comparing the Greek and the Roman, says that when the former worshipped he raised his eyes to heaven, for his prayer was contemplation, while the latter veiled his head, for his was reflection. Essentially like the Roman conception of religion, our reflection brought into prominence not so much the moral as the national consciousness of the individual. Its nature worship endeared the country to our inmost souls, while its ancestor worship, tracing from lineage to lineage, made the imperial family the fountainhead of the whole nation. To us the country is more than the land and soil from which to mine gold or to reap grain. It is the sacred abode of the gods, the spirits of our forefathers. To us the emperor is more than the arch-constable of a_reichstadt_, or even the patron of a_kulturstadt_. He is the bodily representative of heaven on earth, blending in his person its power and its mercy. If what M. Boutmy says is true of English royalty, that it is not only the image of authority, but the author and symbol of national unity, as I believe it to be, doubly and trebly may this be affirmed of royalty in Japan. The tenets of Shintoism cover the two predominating features of the emotional life of our race: patriotism and loyalty. Arthur Mayknapp very truly says, in Hebrew literature it is often difficult to tell whether the writer is speaking of God or of the Commonwealth, of heaven or of Jerusalem, of the Messiah or of the nation itself. A similar confusion may be noticed in the nomenclature of our national faith. I said confusion, because it will be so deemed by a logical intellect on account of its verbal ambiguity. Still, being a framework of national instinct and race feelings, Shintoism never pretends to a systematic philosophy or a rational theology. This religion, or, is it not more correct to say, the race emotions which this religion expressed? Thoroughly imbued Bushido with loyalty to the sovereign and love of country. These acted more as impulses than as doctrines, for Shintoism, unlike the medieval Christian church, prescribe to its votaries scarcely any _credenda_, furnishing them at the same time with _agenda_ of a straightforward and simple type. As to strictly ethical doctrines, the teachings of Confucius were the most prolific source of Bushido. His enunciation of the five moral relations between master and servant, the governing and the governed, father and son, husband and wife, older and younger brother, and between friend and friend, was but a confirmation of what the race instinct had recognized before his writings were introduced from China. The calm, benignant, and worldly wise character of his politico-ethical precepts was particularly well suited to the samurai, who formed the ruling class. His aristocratic and conservative tone was well adapted to the requirements of these warrior statesmen. Next to Confucius, Mencius exercised an immense authority over Bushido. His forcible and often quite democratic theories were exceedingly taking to sympathetic natures, and they were even thought dangerous to, and subversive of, the existing social order, hence his works were for a long time under censure. Still, the words of this mastermind found permanent lodgment in the heart of the samurai. The writings of Confucius and Mencius formed the principal textbooks for youths and the highest authority in discussion among the old. A mere acquaintance with the classics of these two sages was held, however, in no high esteem. A common proverb ridicules one who has only an intellectual knowledge of Confucius, as a man ever studious but ignorant of _analects_. A typical samurai calls a literary savant a book-smelling sot. Another compares learning to an ill-smelling vegetable that must be boiled and boiled before it is fit for use. A man who has read a little smells a little pedantic, and a man who has read much smells yet more so, both are alike unpleasant. The writer meant thereby that knowledge becomes really such only when it is assimilated in the mind of the learner and shows in his character. An intellectual specialist was considered a machine. Intellect itself was considered subordinate to ethical emotion. Man and the universe were conceived to be alike spiritual and ethical. Bushido could not accept the judgment of Huxley, that the cosmic process was unmoral. Bushido made light of knowledge as such. It was not pursued as an end in itself, but as a means to the attainment of wisdom. Hence, he who stopped short of this end was regarded no higher than a convenient machine, which could turn out poems and maxims at bidding. Thus, knowledge was conceived as identical with its practical application in life, and this Socratic doctrine found its greatest exponent in the Chinese philosopher, Wang Yangming, who never wearies of repeating, "To know and to act are one and the same." I beg leave for a moment's digression while I am on this subject, inasmuch as some of the noblest types of _bushi_ were strongly influenced by the teachings of this sage. Western readers will easily recognize in his writings many parallels to the New Testament. making allowance for the terms peculiar to either teaching, the passage, "Seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you," conveys a thought that may be found on almost any page of Wan Yang Ming. A Japanese disciple of his says the Lord of heaven and earth, of all living beings, dwelling in the heart of man, becomes his mind, underscore kokoro underscore, hence a mind is a living thing, and is ever luminous, and again, the spiritual light of our essential being is pure, and is not affected by the will of man. Spontaneously springing up in our mind, it shows what is right and wrong, it is then called conscience, it is even the light that proceedeth from the God of heaven. How very much do these words sound like some passages from Isaac Pennington or other philosophic mystics? I am inclined to think that the Japanese mind, as expressed in the simple tenets of the Shinto religion, was particularly open to the reception of Yang Ming's precepts. He carried his doctrine of the infallibility of conscience to extreme transcendentalism, attributing to it the faculty to perceive, not only the distinction between right and wrong, but also the nature of psychical facts and physical phenomena. He went as far as, if not farther than, Berkeley and Fichte, in idealism, denying the existence of things outside of human ken. If his system had all the logical errors charged to solipsism, it had all the efficacy of strong conviction, and its moral import in developing individuality of character and equanimity of temper cannot be gainsaid. Thus, whatever the sources, the essential principles which underscore Bushido underscore imbibed from them and assimilated to itself, were few and simple. Few and simple as these were, they were sufficient to furnish a safe conduct of life even through the unsafest days of the most unsettled period of our nation's history. The wholesome, unsophisticated nature of our warrior ancestors derived ample food for their spirit from a sheaf of commonplace and fragmentary teachings, gleaned as it were on the highways and byways of ancient thought, and, stimulated by the demands of the age, formed from these gleanings a new and unique type of manhood. An acute French underscore savant underscore, M. de la Maiselier, thus sums up his impressions of the 16th century: toward the middle of the 16th century, all is confusion in Japan, in the government, in society, in the church. But the civil wars, the manners returning to barbarism, the necessity for each to execute justice for himself, these formed men comparable to those Italians of the 16th century, in whom Taine praises the vigorous initiative, the habit of sudden resolutions and desperate undertakings, the grand capacity to do and to suffer. In Japan as in Italy, the rude manners of the Middle Ages made of man a superb animal, wholly militant and wholly resistant. And this is why the 16th century displays in the highest degree the principal quality of the Japanese race, that great diversity which one finds there between minds, underscore esprit underscore, as well as between temperaments. While in India and even in China men seem to differ chiefly in degree of energy or intelligence, in Japan they differ by originality of character as well. Now, individuality is the sign of superior races and of civilizations already developed. If we make use of an expression dear to Nietzsche, we might say that in Asia, to speak of humanity is to speak of its plains, in Japan as in Europe, one represents it above all by its mountains. To the pervading characteristics of the men of whom M. de la Maiselier writes, let us now address ourselves. I shall begin with rectitude or justice. The most cogent precept in the code of the samurai. Nothing is more loathsome to him than underhand dealings and crooked undertakings. The conception of rectitude may be erroneous, it may be narrow. A well-known Bushi defines it as a power of resolution. Rectitude is the power of deciding upon a certain course of conduct in accordance with reason, without wavering, to die when it is right to die, to strike when to strike is right. Another speaks of it in the following terms: rectitude is the bone that gives firmness and stature. As without bones the head cannot rest on the top of the spine, nor hands move nor feet stand, so without rectitude neither talent nor learning can make of a human frame a samurai. With it the lack of accomplishments is as nothing. Mencius calls benevolence man's mind, and rectitude or righteousness his path. How lamentable, he exclaims, is it to neglect the path and not pursue it, to lose the mind and not know to seek it again. When men's fowls and dogs are lost, they know to seek for them again, but they lose their mind and do not know to seek for it. Have we not here as in a glass darkly a parable propounded 300 years later in another clime and by a greater teacher, who called himself underscore the way underscore of righteousness, through whom the lost could be found? But I stray from my point. Righteousness, according to Mencius, is a straight and narrow path which a man ought to take to regain the lost paradise. Even in the latter days of feudalism, when the long continuance of peace brought leisure into the life of the warrior class, and with it dissipations of all kinds and gentle accomplishments, the epithet underscore geishi underscore, a man of rectitude, was considered superior to any name that signified mastery of learning or art. The 47 faithfuls of whom so much is made in our popular education are known in common parlance as the 47 Geshe. In times when cunning artifice was liable to pass for military tact and downright falsehood for ruse de guerre, this manly virtue, frank and honest, was a jewel that shone the brightest and was most highly praised. Rectitude is a twin brother to valor, another martial virtue. But before proceeding to speak of valor, let me linger a little while on what I may term a derivation from rectitude, which, at first deviating slightly from its original, became more and more removed from it, until its meaning was perverted in the popular acceptance. I speak of gyri, literally the right reason, but which came in time to mean a vague sense of duty which public opinion expected an incumbent to fulfill. In its original and unalloyed sense, it meant duty, pure and simple. Hence, we speak of the gyri we owe to parents, to superiors, to inferiors, to society at large, and so forth. In these instances gyri is duty, for what else is duty than what right reason demands and commands us to do? Should not right reason be our categorical imperative? Gyri primarily meant no more than duty, and I dare say its etymology was derived from the fact that in our conduct, say to our parents, though love should be the only motive, lacking that, there must be some other authority to enforce filial piety, and they formulated this authority in gyri. Very rightly did they formulate this authority gyri, since if love does not rush to deeds of virtue, recourse must be had to man's intellect and his reason must be quickened to convince him of the necessity of acting right. The same is true of any other moral obligation. The instant duty becomes onerous, right reason steps in to prevent our shirking it. Gyri, thus understood, is a severe taskmaster, with a birch rod in his hand to make sluggards perform their part. It is a secondary power in ethics, as a motive it is infinitely inferior to the Christian doctrine of love, which should be the law. I deem it a product of the conditions of an artificial society, of a society in which accident of birth and unmerited favor instituted class distinctions, in which the family was the social unit, in which seniority of age was of more account than superiority of talents, in which natural affections had often to succumb before arbitrary man-made customs. Because of this very artificiality, gyri in time degenerated into a vague sense of propriety called up to explain this and sanction that, as, for example, why a mother must, if need be, sacrifice all her other children in order to save the firstborn, or why a daughter must sell her chastity to get funds to pay for the father's dissipation, and the like. Starting as right reason, gyri has, in my opinion, often stooped to casuistry. It has even degenerated into cowardly fear of censure. I might say of gyri what Scott wrote of patriotism, that as it is the fairest, so it is often the most suspicious, mask of other feelings. Carried beyond or below right reason, gyri became a monstrous misnomer. It harbored under its wings every sort of sophistry and hypocrisy. It might easily have been turned into a nest of cowardice, if Bushido had not a keen and correct sense of courage, the spirit of daring and bearing. To the consideration of which we shall now return. Courage was scarcely deemed worthy to be counted among virtues, unless it was exercised in the cause of righteousness. In his Analects, Confucius defines courage by explaining, as is often his wont, what its negative is. Perceiving what is right, he says, and doing it not, argues lack of courage. Put this epigram into a positive statement, and it runs, courage is doing what is right. To run all kinds of hazards, to jeopardize oneself, to rush into the jaws of death, these are too often identified with valor, and in the profession of arms such rashness of conduct what Shakespeare calls, valor misbegot, is unjustly applauded, but not so in the precepts of knighthood. Death for a cause unworthy of dying for, was called a dog's death. To rush into the thick of battle and to be slain in it, says a prince of Mito, is easy enough, and the merest churl is equal to the task, but, he continues, it is true courage to live when it is right to live, and to die only when it is right to die, and yet the prince had not even heard of the name of Plato, who defines courage as the knowledge of things that a man should fear and that he should not fear. A distinction which is made in the West between moral and physical courage has long been recognized among us. What samurai youth has not heard of great valor and the valor of a villain? Valor, fortitude, bravery, fearlessness, courage, being the qualities of soul which appeal most easily to juvenile minds, and which can be trained by exercise and example, were, so to speak, the most popular virtues, early emulated among the youth. Stories of military exploits were repeated almost before boys left their mother's breast. Does a little booby cry for any ache? The mother scolds him in this fashion, what a coward to cry for a trifling pain. What will you do when your arm is cut off in battle? What when you are called upon to commit _harakiri_? We all know the pathetic fortitude of a famished little boy prince of Sendai, who in the drama is made to say to his little page, "Seest thou those tiny sparrows in the nest, how they're yellow?"